So the topic that I wanted to talk about today was how we got here. And all that I can really talk about is about how I got here. And so that's the topic of my talk. And then it shouldn't be too time-consuming, so I thought maybe, people could talk. Share their own story, about how they got here. And so I have a little essay that I brought with me, and what it has to say is about is this feeling that I've had towards Zen practice. Which is that there feels like an instinct toward it, like something which is not cognitive, something which is not reasoned out, but an instinct toward it as a means of coming home. It's like a compass. It's like something that is just guiding the way. Almost without really knowing why. And so my essay is about some life experiences that I had, which for me served as the foundation of those instincts that I kind of carry with me, as guidance. As a place to say, yeah, yes, this is the way toward home. And sometimes, those experiences are sometimes they come out of suffering. So my story isn't totally happy, but I hope it's not too sad either. So when I was young, I suffered a great deal. My parents had many difficulties with one another and in their own lives. I was very short for my age. I was very sensitive, and I got teased a lot at school. When I was 14, my father suffered a brain injury in a bicycle accident, which left him with profound cognitive impairments and unable to care for himself. 4 years later, he passed away unexpectedly. In the year after my father's accident, I was very lonely. I tried to care for him as best as I could, to assist with his cognitive therapies and oversee his eating and exercise. But I suffered with frustrations toward him and also with the guilt that I could not be more patient with him. During that year, I found myself seeking very hard to find peace. I spent a lot of time alone. I found solace in writing poetry and journaling, and I questioned the meaningfulness of life. I contemplated the presence of God, and I discovered that maybe I didn't believe in one. I often walked alone at night when it was quiet, and I became familiar with a lucid serenity, which I had no name for. But this feeling settled in my heart as a place to call home. Still, I stayed lonely. I felt a lot of pain, and I began seeking different ways of protecting myself from it. My teenage hobbies became obsessive, and then in my last year of high school, I found drugs. For many years, I preferred the feeling of numbness to the challenges of being in touch with my heart. I did not write or do my walking meditation. Instead of listening or looking deeply, I hid myself from my loneliness. I lived with a straining conflict between an instinct to seek lucidity and the desire to dwell in numbness. In the years after my father died, I found many ways in which to drown out the conflict, but each only brought about further suffering. During my second year as a graduate student in New York City, my life changed. At the time, I had been engaged to my longtime girlfriend, even though our relationship was very unhappy. at the end of our relationship caused a lot of pain to her and her family, and also to myself and to my own family. But what followed was perhaps my own realization of what I understand karma to be. The suffering that I experienced could be passed on to other people, and it could cause suffering for them as well. And this humbling realization instilled in me a deep commitment not to cause further suffering to others, and to find the origin of it in myself. My discovery was that my continued suffering arose from the habit of turning away. In the coming years, I found that habit to be very challenging to unlearn, but I also discovered that having the courage to look deeply could be practiced and nourished, and I became kinder and more patient with myself. What I wish to say is that I believe in a part of ourselves which knows the way home. It's like water flowing downhill, in that it will do so on its own. It will find its own way. And so for us, not forcing it may be the way. Still, it may require courage and dedication for us to learn the practice of yielding, how to be water flowing downhill. The wonderful part of that courage and dedication of this kind is that it turns out to be nourishing in and of itself. And this, to me, is what we call right effort. I wonder whether there has been a compass for each one of us. Perhaps a sensation of the heart saying, yes, this is the way, when we've recognized truth. I feel deep gratitude that when I was young, I suffered a lot. That suffering to me was like walking barefoot on a riverbed of jagged stones. And so stumbling upon the feeling of equanimity was like finding a foothold on one which was smooth and stable. This is why we don't have to throw things out, because no difficulty arises which is not also an opportunity for our practice. Although I've strayed very far from home, and I still get lost from time to time, I'm learning to have courage. I practice Zazen to solidify this intention, always to be listening deeply. Zazen is the expression of my commitment not to be afraid. So, what I have wanted to share with everybody was that this is how I got here. That feeling of real happiness, you know, when things are not necessarily they're not necessarily exciting, you know, they're not they don't have to be glamorous or sparkly and shiny but sometimes they're we find ourselves in a kind of happiness which is just easy. There's no attachment, there's no judgment, there's no holding. And it's those times in my life that I felt that kind of happiness, that it stood out to me, that said, yeah, this is the kind of way to practice. And when I began reading Zen literature, what I found was that it gave me a means of articulating that feeling. The terms non-attachment and equanimity really resonated with that recognition that I felt that there was a way of being happy by just being. And I think the other thing that I'm saying is that learning this way takes a lot of courage. And it's a certain kind of courage, which is not, it's not a reckless courage. It's not the kind that we are putting armor on ourselves and just running out there and as if the world was a battlefield and ready to fight it. It's not that kind of courage. It's a different kind, which is the kind of courage which takes sensitivity. It's the courage that helps us to be okay with how things are and to help to help, which helps us to recognize the way that we already are and the way that things are and the way that the people around us are. And the reason that that takes courage is because what we find is not always what we were hoping for. And so it takes some practice to look at things on their own terms, to see things as they already are, and not in the way that we necessarily wish for them to be. Some of you who already know me know that my work, my livelihood is in science, and that's, in science, this same kind of courage is actually necessary. We can't look at things with the expectation that they are already what we think they are. We have to approach them on their own terms and be willing to find whatever is there, whatever story is there to be told. If we take our own story, our own assumptions about nature to it, we won't have the wonderful experience of finding out how it actually is, and we won't make discoveries. And I think the same thing applies in our practice, that if we take our assumptions and our stories or theories to ourselves, and we seek for those things, we may find them, but we may not be open to a much more vast and more beautiful reality, which is there when we have the courage to put those things down. So I wanted to say just one more thing. I don't know how long we've been, but the only other thing that I wanted to say was that for me, I came to Jikoji to practice Zen. But I stayed here because of the Sangha. And in my experience, that practice of Zen has become inseparable from the experience of Sangha. It's the same. I think that everyone here is my teacher, and that I would not have any guidance. I wouldn't have any. I wouldn't know where to go if it wasn't for the people here, who are there to ring the bell in the morning and get me up out of bed at 5:45. I just wanted to say thank you to all the people here who are the Sangha, and express the gratitude that I feel for your being here. Okay, so those are all the words that I can come up with. So thank you for listening, and I just like to hear what you all have to say.
Well, Jonathan, thanks for your courage.
Also, on behalf of the Sangha, the rest of the Sangha here besides yourself, that it may be so that everyone here is your teacher, but everyone here is also your student, too. So thank you for being here. Mutual.
I like that, what you said about the Sangha and the Zen sort of becomes inseparable. That's how I found it, too. Every group has their, they put their stamp on it. It permeates your experience. And Mike's talk a couple of weeks ago, where he said we're like conspirators here. You know, thought about that.
Guerrilla warfare.
Guerrilla, yeah, of course. I like that, yeah. I mean, not the kind of courage you were talking about. every now and again in the old literature, they have this little phrase, do not be deceived by others. You know, sounds very... but there, it's very easy to take up kind of the common delusion of the society we're in about what's important, what's worthwhile, what we should be doing. We're social creatures, you know, and peer pressure. You absorb it. You can't even. You have to fight against it to not. And then eventually, if you're just constantly surrounded by it, it sort of overwhelms you. So, but you can come here and, you know, people are sort of shedding that and they're supporting each other with the sort of same ideals, right? Mm-hmm. It's very comforting and mm-hmm. strong.
It's really easy to think that it's quite silly to spend an hour and a half every day staring at a wall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's easy to see it as silly. And when you work around other scientists, they'll kind of think you're a little crazy.
Right.
So, but when you have the opportunity to practice with people who understand the importance of sitting and staring at a wall, it's very supportive.
I appreciated your story, and I like that thing of not, you know, turning away from the things that are uncomfortable. And I heard this thing this week that was, you know, we bury our feelings, and then we bury them alive. And I just have that image of these, like, things, like, wriggling around inside our body. And I find for myself when I, you know, incorporate Zazen into my daily life that I allow those feelings to have a presence, you know, to be felt. And to me, that's, you know, where the freedom comes from, is, you know, actually having space to have my feelings and not judge myself for having them.
Yeah.
You know, because there's so much, like, I should be fun and happy and joyous, and, you know, sometimes I'm not like that, and I am learning to love myself and accept myself when I'm not in those happy, joyous places, and that's part of who I am, and that's okay too. So thanks for that.
Yeah, I understand that feeling. I think there's a difficult concept to get used to, which for me was when I started practicing Zen, was the non-attachment. Because to me, non-attachment actually meant detachment. And I thought maybe it was non-attachment meant to cultivate a way of kind of not caring, being apathetic toward all the sensations that we feel. And over time, I kind of changed what I thought my meaning of non-attachment was. It's not detachment. It's more like an embodiment. It's knowing and actually being extremely sensitive to all of those feelings that would otherwise have been buried alive, right? But our non-attachment is actually necessary for that kind of sensitivity. because if we bring our attachments to it, then we're not listening. You know, we're stuck on some other feeling. You know, we're not giving the current ones, the ones that are happening in the moment, a chance to express themselves. So actually, in non-attachment, actually facilitates the opposite of not caring or apathy or detachment. Non-attachment actually cultivates sensitivity. So,
just on the topic of Sangha, I just want to draw attention that John, Padma, and Patrick are not in this room, but they're preparing food for us, and it's amazing just how much we've been benefiting from the families around here, especially them, and how much an 11-year-old can be our teacher. and also even the larger group that just milled past, that they have been, and they will share their food with us. So I just also just, it's amazing the kind of people that come to Jikoji, and all of you included, is part of the larger Sangha, and it's how amazing that there's this magnet, essentially, for wonderful people in the world to bring themselves.
So, yeah, John's family has been one of our residents. John has had his family staying with us for the last month or so. And so has his wife and his 11-year-old son, Patrick. And that's
from,
been...
They're from India, right?
Yeah. Who currently live in India. It's funny, your choice of of words, because we were talking about magnets a lot. Patrick has these really strong magnets that he's always playing with, and and John is always encouraging him to ask me about magnetism so I can explain magnetism to him, but he really just wants to know other things. I can't explain magnetic dipoles to he's having too much fun with them. It would take the fun out of it. And Saiko.
I'm very touched by your clarity of yourself, and that's very makes me very hopeful about humanity, and that's wonderful. And I also feel like when you are talking about you, when you are little, when you are, you know, you have a lot of emotions, and I felt for that. you know, and you also now enjoy being home. Being home, and I'm glad for that little boy that was hurt then to feel home again, and that's a wonderful imagery that you are able to express. And I also wanted to, I'm very touched by the fact that Jikoji provides such a container to have this kind of honesty expressed and feel safe. And that's to the credit of every single one of you, and you know, the container that you're creating at this temple.
Also, it's somewhat of a tradition, at least in America, to have what's called a way-seeking mind talk for a student to tell the story of how they came to practice.
Okay.
So this is actually part of the tradition,
okay. Actually, in a way, too.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
That was an accident.
Nothing's an accident.
thank you. So, Seiko, your talk that you gave for us last week at the Science and Buddhism discussion was very inspiring. And speaking of clarity, that was what struck me, was your emotional and spiritual clarity. And I think it's a great skill to speak with so much honesty, and also feeling. We've been having some discussions about science and Buddhism that Cliff has facilitated for us.
Yeah. Will those continue, by the way, Cliff? Are they?
It's scheduled for the last Saturdays of the month, at least for June, but
Sundays.
I'm not sure. We'll see.
So the next one is?
June 25th, I think.
25th. Mm-hmm. Okay.
June 29th.
It's a Sundays, right. Last Sunday. So that series is kind of continuing with a slightly more specific topic, which is Buddhism and healing, or Buddhism and maybe Western therapies, and you know how this. So Sayoko is a professional, and so she came and gave us and talked to us about her own experiences with her practice and how it has helped her in her professional activities with helping people who are struggling, it was very, very nice, because there's actually, so I'm familiar with, on a personal basis, with some people who are professional psychologists, and they take a very academic approach toward the utility of mindfulness in their therapies. I became aware of a lot of like kind of academic push and pull and contention between different professionals who are all arguing about the right way to apply Buddhist principles in their therapies, and whether or not they even should be, and all these things. But what Sayoko talked to us about, at least what I took away from it, was just a wholehearted report of her own experience in therapies, and how her relationship with Buddhism has been able to help. So that was really refreshing. And far less argumentative than what I hear in academic circles. So.
One more question. What Psycho mentioned and what you talked about practice as coming home or going home. I'm wondering if you could expand on that a little bit more about what that is for you.
Yeah, so for me, I didn't have much of a sense of home. I think there wasn't really a safe place, you know. So I think that I spent a lot of dysfunctional energy in kind of fashioning a kind of a safe place. But as I talked about in my essay, that really, you know, led to a lot more struggle, more suffering. What I feel like is a real home, you know, is it's a place where that just expresses your comfort in the world, you know, your comfort as a person, you know, your willingness to be here, you know, your wish to be here, you know, and but the reason that home is such a good word, I think, is because it implies a sense of safety. That I think that sense of safety is what I mean by non-fear, you know. Home means a place where you're not afraid. So, you know, when we sit zazen, we may experience different kinds of fears, like they may come up, but having this container, you know, as you say, it's this place to practice, it's a place where we're not threatened by those fears, and we can just check them out, you know, just see where they came from and where they're going. And what I felt was over time, you know, it's like more solidity, you know, more comfort, you know, more willingness to just be myself. That's a feeling of being at home, you know, being able to be yourself. Yeah. Joe, did you have something?
Yeah, you mentioned you were taught that being Jay told you whatever represented your commitment, not to be a phrase. What's your relationship with spirit now? Has it worked out that well? Or?
Yeah, I'm still afraid of bobcats. Yeah, and chickens, it turns out. So. but not of Zazen. So I don't know. Has it worked out? I've enjoyed living here. So it's worked out.